What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Josh Vital, a Jewish tourist who was imprisoned for over a year and a half in Iran after crossing the border by mistake. And he's written about it in his new book, A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Borel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. Or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. What a strange and disturbing Memorial Day weekend it was last week. At a time dedicated to remembering those who died defending our country, new deaths occurred in very different places for very different reasons, but for disturbing reasons. The execution-style anti-Semitic attack at the Jewish Museum in Brussels that killed two Israelis and a French Jew, as well as a Belgian museum employee. The brutal anti-Semitic attack on two Jewish young men leaving a synagogue south of Paris that left them hospitalized with serious injuries. And the awful killing spree of a disturbed man in Isla Vista, California, that ended with seven young people dead and 13 injured, gave us the sense that there is something very wrong in our world. Well, there is, but there are things that are wrong, and they are three very different kinds of things that are wrong that all led to violence. First, while we know very little about the attackers in Belgium and France, anti-Semitism remains a profound concern for Jews all over Europe. The governments of both countries, France and Belgium, have acted decisively to support their Jewish citizens and to try to guarantee that justice will be done. But the fact that in 2014, nearly 70 years after the end of the Holocaust, Jews are attacked simply because they are Jews is troubling and distressing. Our hearts go out to the families of these new martyrs of the bloodiest continent and to the wounded and their families. May these prove to be isolated incidents rather than harbingers of ugly things to come. Second, the slaughter in Isla Vista, California, the Santa Barbara college town where I spent some of my 5 years in that lovely place, demonstrated again that mentally disturbed people in our society are not generally very successfully controlled or helped, particularly after they turn 18 years old. We have a strange, disconnected, underfunded, and often ineffective mental health system. And if anything, over the past 30 years, it has gotten to be less systematic and less effective. There are many deeply dedicated people working hard to help those who are emotionally challenged. And we have learned a great deal about mental illness in the past few decades. But the odd bias we retain in America against viewing mental illness as a treatable kind of disease, and the strange patchwork of laws that often keep people who should be in residential care on the street, as well as a terrible shortage of such residential care facilities, makes it all a bit of a mess. The man who perpetrated this massacre of the innocents had wealthy parents who tried to help him, but there was no legal way to stop him from this horrible attack in advance, or so everyone says. Well, we need to be able to prevent this kind of thing, even at the expense of some measurable amount of civil liberties. You know, psychiatry was essentially developed by Jews like Sigmund Freud, and as my wife says, therapy is Jewish golf. But therapy cannot solve all problems or scuttle all ticking time bombs, and we need to have the ability to control those who simply cannot control themselves and deliberately endanger others. Third, and this is beginning to sound like a sickening, repeating message, we must have laws that prevent people like this clearly disturbed young man from buying semi-automatic weapons easily. This 22-year-old had three guns purchased legally, and his history of mental illness did not preclude him from doing so, even in a state like California, which makes that far more difficult than many other states in America. The statistics are pretty obvious and pretty nauseating. We Americans shoot each other a lot. We own a whole lot of guns, far more than any other country, nearly one for every human being in the United States. That combination of madness and guns is not a good one. It has resulted in Gabby Gifford's shooting, in Aurora, Colorado's killings, in Newtown, Connecticut's martyred kindergartners, and now in Santa Barbara's Isla Vista college murders. And we simply can't seem to do anything meaningful about it, which means it will likely keep on happening. God forbid. Chas v'chalila. But it just happened again. We pray for the families of those murdered in Santa Barbara and in Belgium, and we pray as well for the souls of those who died so needlessly. Zichronam livracha, may their memories be a blessing, and may their deaths move us to productive action speedily. You know, it was also Yom Yerushalayim last week, the day when Israel celebrated the reunification of Jerusalem during the Six-Day War in 1967, and the moment when we were again, as Jews, able to reach the Kotel, the Western Wall, to pray there after being blocked from this holiest site in the world for years. To play us in this morning, here's a classic song about Jerusalem, written just before the Six-Day War by Naomi Shemer, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. The original three verses are filled with longing for this eternal capital of the Jewish people, with Jews then prevented from any access to the holiest place by the guns of the Jordanian army. But a fourth additional verse added by Naomi Shemer just after the war is filled with hope after the liberation of the old city allowed us to come again to Jerusalem of Gold, as sung by its original singer, Shuli Natan. That was Shuli Natan singing the classic song Yerushalayim Shel Zahav for Jerusalem Day, Yom Yerushalayim, last week. Josh Fatal is a Jewish author and one of three American hikers imprisoned in Iran for over a year and a half. His story is truly amazing. Don't miss hearing it when we return in a few moments on Too Jewish.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU, dream it, do it, visit asu.edu.
We welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Josh Vital. In the summer of 2009, he, Shane Bauer, and Sarah Shard were hiking in Iraqi Kurdistan and unknowingly crossed into Iran. They were captured by a border patrol, accused of spying, and found themselves in Tehran's infamous Evin prison, where, well, their survival was a matter of will and perhaps even chance. The new book they wrote is called A Sliver of Light. In this memoir, they get to tell their side of the story. Good morning and welcome, Josh.
Good morning. Thanks, Sam.
Tell me a little bit. The first question that came to me, I'm sure it's not the first time you've been asked, is interesting place to choose to go hiking. Talk a little bit about that decision.
It is an interesting place. If you're interested to go, I can tell you where it is, but I think that's maybe
not something most of our listeners are jumping at the opportunity to do.
Yeah, I guess I made that waterfall famous in a way.
I'll rephrase the question. What's a nice Jewish boy who's now a PhD candidate doing hiking in Iraqi Kurdistan on the border of Iran?
I was a teaching fellow on an international university program in 2009, and I was taking the spring semester. It was a group of 30 American students. We went to Switzerland, India, China, and South Africa. There's a program called Health and Community, looking at the political economy of healthcare around the world. When that program ended, before returning to the U.S., I visited my friends who were living in Syria at the time. They're friends that I know from undergraduate school, and Shane was a freelance journalist in Damascus. And, they had a little break in their work schedule, and we said, let's go somewhere we can't go on a weekend. And they told me that Iraqi Kurdistan was a safe place, and they encouraged me to go there. So we all went. I trusted them on that. There was actually someone that I met while I was there that had just visited Iraqi Kurdistan. So, Iraqi Kurdistan, we were there for like 3 days. We went to the city of Erbil, the city of Sulaymaniyah. But then after a while, we said, we were looking at all these pictures of nature. And we said, we asked a couple of people, where do we go to get out of the city? And they both, the taxi driver and the hotel manager, pointed to the same place, Amidala. Went there. It's kind of a big touristy spot. There's a bunch of people, like local tourists who are there and by the waterfall. But then we went there, but then what we did, which was the unadvisable part, not knowing where we were precisely, we walked up past the waterfall and continued hiking for a few hours until we got to the borderline and even crossed into, accidentally, Iran.
It seems like a kind of a completely innocent experience. It led to some dramatic, traumatic, and really extraordinary experiences. Josh, you were the only Jewish member of the trio?
I was, yeah. The other two aren't.
We will explore how that all played out when we come back with Josh Vital talking about A Sliver of Light, their new book on being imprisoned in Iran for several years, when we come back on Two Jewish. Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road Office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have 3 stores. We're opening a 4th in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Poet Maya Angelou died last week, and although she wasn't Jewish, we dedicate our poetry slam this morning to her great poem on freedom, a subject we Jews know well. It's called I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. The free bird leaps on the back of the wind and floats downstream till the current ends and dips his wings in the orange sun rays and dares to claim the sky. But a bird that stalks down his narrow cage can seldom see through his bars of rage. His wings are clipped and his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. The caged bird sings with fearful trill of the things unknown, but longed for still, and his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom. The free bird thinks of another breeze, and the trade wind soft through the sighing trees, and the fat worms waiting on a dawn-bright lawn, and he names the sky his own. But a caged bird stands on the grave of dreams, his shadow shouts on a nightmare scream, his wings are clipped and his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. The caged bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still, and his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom. That was Maya Angelou's great poem, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. May her memory be a blessing. We welcome our Mivi Nan, Israel Oshot Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshot.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So, Israel is a beautiful country, but it's not a very big country. People compare it in size to New Jersey. Some people have told me that it's just a little larger than Pima County, where we happen to live here in Tucson. Well over 7 million people living there, up from 6 million, I don't know, 10 years ago or so. Where is Israel going to put all the increase in its population? Because they're still having lots of kids and people are still emigrating to Israel.
Maybe we'll fulfill Ben-Gurion's dream and people will live in the Negev.
Right, the deserts?
Yeah, the desert.
He used to, Ben-Gurion, of course, the visionary first prime minister of Israel, the leader of the Yeshuv before that, used to calculate that there probably were 1 million Jews living in the Negev in biblical times because it was much more heavily settled. Certainly aren't there 1 million living there now.
I don't think million, but I don't think it's too far away from million.
Because of the growth in Beersheba.
Yeah, yeah. Like for the last 10 years, they did a lot of work with the Ben-Gurion University, and they really, really did, also the Jewish Agency and other organization put a lot of effort to, I would say, flourish the Galil and the Negev, and there is even minister for Galil and Negev, so there is a lot of effort to put more Jews at the Galil and Negev.
So in addition to the Negev and the south, the desert, the Galil is the Galilee, beautiful area,
beautiful.
Yom Kinneret, the beautiful Sea of Galilee. But interestingly, not very heavily populated. It's a major agricultural region still. Why don't more people live in the Galilee?
It was one of the first areas. Most of the great wine are coming from.
Great wines, you know? Yes, absolutely.
So I think for the Galil, for the Golan, I guess you know why people are a bit hesitating. I think if the peace process...
And if the Golan gets given back to
but
Syria
the Galil,
or something.
But like most of it, like some of the Galil is like near, next to the Mediterranean Sea. It's a beautiful area. And
Emek Israel runs right down. It's a beautiful country.
And you know, from side to side, Israel is 5 hours. So it's you know, it's not
very big.
5 hours. One of the people that just went to Israel, I show him a very huge map of Israel, and I ask him to guess how long it will take from Metula to Eilat. He said 5 days. I told him, try 5 hours.
5 hours.
So it doesn't make sense.
And
like,
I've seen the way Israelis drive, so I believe 5 hours. You could do it.
Yeah, 5 hours legally.
Legally. Oh, I'm not sure.
So anyway, I don't know why most of the people want to live like around Tel Aviv. I just explained that, you know, you can in 5 hours, even less. And now I know that the Israel government putting a lot of effort to do one highway from, you know, across the country and really to make it easy so people will live like at the Galil, at the Golan, Emek Beit She'an.
Right. Your hometown of Beit She'an.
And the Negev, of course. And so it will be, they still can go and work in the, you know, center of Israel, but live in a very good life, you know, echut chaim, so they have a quality of life. Yeah,
right.
At the Galil, and so we don't need to worry. Even if it will grow twice time in 5 years, we have a place where to live in Israel.
Well, it's good to hear that overpopulation isn't the issue. It's just getting people to live in some of the other beautiful areas of Israel.
Nachon.
Thanks, Oshrat. We'll talk next week.
Toda, litrot.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about that most cheerful of all subjects, anti-Semitism, but in particular exploring now the Jews who remain in what's today Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, I suppose, the country sort of on the fringe of the former Soviet Empire, former Soviet republics. What kind of anti-Semitism should we be concerned about? How concerned should we be? What does it mean for Jews living here?
Well, it's an interesting question that has to be looked at sort of in two chapters, or sub-chapters, as it were. First, the Jews in places like Ukraine, Belarus, Moldova, et cetera, that were living in the Pale of Settlement. So the percentages of the population that were Jewish were high. And these are places where the soil and the air and apparently the mother's milk is just impregnated with anti-Semitism. And it's passed on irrationally, whether there are a lot of Jews or a few Jews. These are places that were all too eager to help the Nazis accomplish their goal of exterminating the Jewish people.
I'm reminded of Sacha Baron Cohen as Borat singing Throw the Jews Down the Well.
Right. Well, so there's this place right outside of Kiev called Babi Yar, which was memorialized by a great Russian poet, Yevgeny Yevtushenko. But it's also an example of Ukraine trying to come to terms with its past and trying to educate young people to be less irrational. So I would say that a more stable, more prosperous, more democratic, more comfortable Ukraine would not look to scapegoat Jews necessarily today. A Ukraine that feels threatened or impoverished or where parties are squabbling over position and influence would tend to use the Jews as a scapegoat and would likely be successful in doing so because they're playing on ground that's already well plowed. By contrast, in the Russian Federation, you have a very different story, which is that until the 20th century, in Russia itself, the Jewish population was very limited. And it was limited to a few sort of court Jews who were allowed in for specific reasons, to be doctors, lawyers, violinists, whatever. And then it started growing in the 20th century with the dawn of a parliamentary democracy, however fragile it was under Kerensky, and then the Russian Revolution, where a lot of the architects and the leading players were Jewish or of Jewish origin or of Jewish ancestry. And so Jews became used by both sides in what was a long civil war, the Russian Revolution. Jews were blamed by both sides, on the one hand for being supporters of the Tsar and the old regime and profiteering and all that, and on the other hand for being the architects of the revolution. And both sides were, in some sense, right, because, you know, since when do all Jews share one opinion or one political position? Never. And that was true in Russia, too. But today, the fact is that a lot of the most influential people politically, economically, financially in Russia, a lot of the people with a lot of clout are Jewish. So when things tend to go wrong, or when you look at some of Putin's cronies or some of the most influential TV personalities or comedians, stand-up comics, I mean, they're Jerry Seinfeld. They're all Odessa Jews, and Odessa is now part of Ukraine, technically, but now that it's, the Nile of Crimea has been annexed back by Russia, Odessa mm-hmm. is now once again a Russian city, and it's an important center of Russian Jewish culture and particularly Russian Jewish humor. So the fate of Odessa has a lot to say about the fate of Russia in general and Russian Jewry in particular.
We will talk more about this next week. Fascinating subject. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Two friends, Moshe and Abe, find themselves delivered together to hell. A little confused, they are startled to see a door in the wall open, and behind the door is probably the ugliest woman they have ever seen or even nightmared about. She is 3'4" tall, dirty, covered in thick black hair. Flies circle her. They can smell her, even over the acrid odor of brimstone. The voice of the devil is heard. Moshe, you have sinned. You are condemned to spend the rest of eternity in bed with this woman. And Moshe groans as he's whipped through the door by a group of lesser demons to his permanent torment. This shakes up Abe. He jumps when a second door opens. And as the door inches open, he strains to see the figure of the magnificently beautiful supermodel Kate Upton. Delighted, Abe jumps up, looking at this gorgeous woman in a skimpy bikini. He must be headed for heaven. How wonderful! And then he hears the voice of the devil saying, Kate, you have sinned. That was indeed the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week our portion Bahalotcha comes from the book of Numbers, and it's filled with a series of incidents and events from the wilderness days, as well as some important commandments. It's in this week's portion that instructions are given to create the first menorah, the seven-branched candelabrum that has become the most enduring symbol of Judaism and the symbol of the State of Israel. It's also here that we get the first rumblings of rebellion that will explode into full-fledged revolt against Moses and Aaron in just a few more weeks, the disastrous story of Korach. But most significant in this week's Seder is a peculiar little story about gossip. Moses has married a new wife, and his brother and sister, Aaron and Miriam, don't think much of her. So they begin to talk about her and about Moses behind his back, circulating rumors and gossip. She's not of the right ethnicity, they don't like her influence on Moses, she probably laughs inappropriately or wears her hair too long. The response by God is swift and decisive. Miriam, although oddly not Aaron, comes down with a dread ailment. Moses' siblings realize the error of their gossiping ways, and they repent and are healed. But the point is made. Gossip and slander are among the most destructive influences in society. If we don't avoid them, we will indeed have sorrows, trouble, and heartache. If we can avoid them, we have every chance to build a society of holiness and goodness. It's a great message today. As the Talmud teaches, gossip injures three people, the speaker, the listener, and the subject. It hurts the person who gossips, the one who listens to gossip, and the person who is gossiped about. All are morally damaged by the experience. No one benefits. Circulating rumors, sharing personal information about others, accurate or not, is not the way to create genuine community or intimacy. Lashon Hara, the unethical use of speech, is attractive to many, but it is wrong and destructive. There are many other things to talk about, all of them more valuable. A famous dictum says that great minds speak about ideas, smaller minds speak about events, and the smallest minds speak about others. May we learn from our portion of Baha'u'llah that the best way to use speech is to build and heal and learn and teach, not to engage in gossip. Josh Fatal was a young man on an adventurous trip in the Middle East when he and two friends went for a hike near the border of Iran. What happened next defies belief, and it helped Josh affirm his Jewish identity under the worst possible circumstances. We'll hear his extraordinary story when we come back on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU, dream it, do it. Visit asu.edu.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Pope Francis's visit to Israel, Jordan, and the Palestinian Authority last weekend was a hectic round of symbolic appearances, religious services, and intriguing meetings. It was a clear public relations triumph for the Pope, who was commemorating the 50th anniversary of the first papal visit to the Holy Land. His jovial manner, warmth, and personal flair for connecting with people were evident throughout to all who met him or followed his path. A day after meeting with Palestinian leaders and pleasing Palestinians by calling attention to their incipient statehood and spontaneously praying at the border fence near Bethlehem, in that section it's a concrete barrier and it made for a great photo op, Pope Francis made a concerted effort to engage Israelis positively too. In a whirlwind itinerary through Jerusalem that could only have been created for a visiting head of state or, well, the Pope, the pontiff met with President Shimon Peres, whom he invited to a prayer service at the Vatican with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. They apparently both accepted. He met with the two chief rabbis of Israel, Ashkenazic and Sephardic, prayed at the Kotel, the Western Wall, became the first pope ever to lay a wreath on the grave of Theodor Herzl, the founding father of Zionism, and spoke movingly at Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum, where he also kissed the hands of Israeli Jews who were survivors of the Nazi genocide. Pope Francis also accommodated a request from Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, who, after seeing the Pope stop to pray in Bethlehem at the separation fence that divides Israel from Palestinian-controlled regions and keeps terrorists out, asked the pontiff to add a stop to his schedule, a memorial to victims of terror attacks, which Netanyahu pointed out was the reason the border fence was put up. In a bantering moment later, the Pope and Netanyahu lightly argued about whether Jesus spoke Hebrew or Aramaic. The answer is probably both. Every single gesture on this trip had significance, says Jeffrey Wolf, a scholar of Christian-Jewish relations at Bar-Ilan University. Because we live in an internet age which cultivates superficial thought, we have no idea how powerful these things can be. But in the Middle East, it resonates very powerfully. All these actions are loaded. He crammed a lot of meaning into a few hours. Indeed, he did. The Pope visited the Dome of the Rock as well, met with a Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, whom he urged to embrace nonviolence. Good luck with that. Prayed at the Jordan River and in Bethlehem. The Pope highlighted the challenges Christians face under the Palestinian Authority, where their numbers have been diminishing, in part because of emigration away from the Islamists who dominate that culture. Pope Francis's visit to the Western Wall, a normal stop for every VIP in Israel, carried particular significance for Jewish Israelis. For 2,000 years, the destruction of the temple was the symbol of the rejection of the Jews, Wolf says. And now the Pope went to the wall. That's an affirmation, a powerful switch, that Catholics no longer believe the Jews are a fossil religion. Well, the Pope certainly doesn't. This visit also carried a modern ecumenical message. The pontiff, after turning from the Kotel, embraced two old friends from his native Argentina, a rabbi and an imam, who were traveling companions on the trip. Perhaps the key moment for Jews was the fact that the Pope did what no pontiff has ever done. He went to the grave of Theodor Herzl, the Austrian journalist who championed the idea of a Jewish homeland when nobody believed it made sense, when he realized anti-Semitism in Europe could not be overcome. This gesture was an effort to undo a kind of long-time slight. The first pontiff to visit Israel, Pope Pius X, sharply rejected Zionism. Francis's move also represents a kind of clear symbolic belief in Israel's right to exist. It's a powerful statement. In non-Pope-related news, this was a tough week. Two anti-Semitic attacks last weekend left four people dead at the Jewish Museum in Brussels and two severely wounded in an attack outside a French synagogue. The carefully planned assault on the Jewish Museum in Belgium was perpetrated by a man using a Kalashnikov rifle who coolly entered the museum, shot and killed two Israelis and a French Jew, and mortally wounded a Belgian museum employee before escaping. Most of Europe is now hunting for the suspect, caught in a surveillance camera video within the museum. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu said the murders in Brussels were the result of a constant incitement against the State of Israel by various agents in the Middle East and Europe itself. Well, that's possible, but not yet clear from the evidence at hand. Also over last weekend, two young men wearing yarmulkes and walking to the synagogue in the town of Créteil, about 70 kilometers south of Paris, were attacked by two unnamed men. Albert El-Harar, president of the Jewish community of Créteil, said that one of the brothers was severely injured after being struck in the eye with a brass knuckle. He's expected to be hospitalized for a couple of weeks. The attacks, both of them, were strongly condemned by French President François Hollande and Belgian Prime Minister Elieu de Rupo, and the president of the European Commission, José Manuel Durão, who said that we must do everything to fight against anti-Semitism and racism. These attacks have prompted fears of a rise of anti-Semitism in Europe. And in the other terrible attack last weekend in my former city of Santa Barbara, California, in the university area of Isla Vista, seven people were left dead and 14 wounded at the hands of a deranged young man who finished his murderous spree by killing himself. There is a strange Jewish connection here. The grandfather of the guy suspected in this mass killing was a famed British photojournalist who took iconic photos of Jewish survivors and mass graves at liberated concentration camps in the final weeks of World War II. Police identified Elliot Roger, age 22, as the gunman who drove through Isla Vista in a black BMW, shooting people and running them over in the beachside community where so many college students live. Elliot Rogers' father is an acclaimed British film director named Peter Rogers, who worked on The Hunger Games. The suspect's grandfather was George Roger, a renowned British photographer who gained notoriety for his gripping wartime shots. George Roger was one of the first photojournalists to reach Bergen-Belsen concentration camp after it was liberated, and he took iconic photos of Jewish survivors and of the mass graves that provided a historical record of the horrors that took place in the camp. The photographer, George Roger, went on to help found the Magnum Photo Agency. He later told interviewers that he was haunted by the fact that he spent most of his time in Bergen-Belsen looking for well-composed photos. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. He's Josh Vital, He was an innocent hiker and became an author, and in between was imprisoned in Iran. The book is called A Sliver of Light. It's about the story of how Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatale, and Sarah Shard were hiking in Iraqi Kurdistan, accidentally crossed over the border, which we heard about in the first part of the show today, and then were captured and imprisoned in Iran. Tell us what happened. You had just kind of inadvertently crossed over the Iraqi Kurdistan border into Iran. When did you know something was wrong?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're just hiking in the hills up this valley. We're in Iraqi Kurdistan, this place that, you know, later I was to find out that while I was in prison, the New York Times wrote it up in the top 41 places to go to visit. And it's sort of a safe region of the world, but it's not. But then, obviously, hiking onto the border was not the place to go. And we, when we went up to the valley, there was sort of a natural point, this sort of the ridge between, you know, one side of the hill and the next. We figured we'd just go there and turn back. And where we were heading, in fact, we realized there was a soldier with a gun on that ridge, and he waved us forward to him. And then we went, not even thinking that he was Iranian, until when we approached, I could see that he had an Iranian flag on his lapel, and that's when it started going downhill. I mean, literally, we went downhill from that ridge and went to a police station. And outside the police station, I remember they interrogated me. They did also. It was like this really kind of ridiculous interrogation. I remember they asked to prove that I was American. They asked if I would spell supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. They asked me all sorts of weird, like, you know. But then after that interrogation, they put us into a van and shifted us to like some other place. We were blindfolded in between. And I remember there was a guy, there was an official that was kind of on this tirade about what the U.S. government had done to these Iranian diplomats. He kept saying they were detained for over 2 years. And I remember thinking, well, that's between these two governments. It doesn't have anything to do with me. You could just release me. And also, what is 2 years? I mean, I'm just here for a couple hours. Send me back. Because that was day one. You know, 781 days later, it took until I was going to be free, a little over 2 years.
It's kind of a stunning and horrible turn of events. The three of you were together initially. Tell us a little bit about what the process was. You know, here you were arrested, interrogated, and then imprisoned.
Yeah, I mean, the first 3 days were really disorienting. Like I said, they were shuttling us from place to place. They didn't really know what to do with us. It was three Americans showing up near on their border, and you could kind of see and feel their confusion. At one point, one of the younger guards was being friendly to me, and he wrote down his email. And he said, "Email me when we send you back. Email me." He wanted to be friendly, and when his superiors found out what he did, they came back into the room and made me give him the email address and rip it up and take it away. So there was like this confused feeling at first, and it was confused for them, and it was extremely disorienting for me. After 3 days, they took me to me and my two cohorts. They took us to Tehran. It was like an 8-hour drive one day, and there they separated us and put us in solitary confinement for a while. Shane and Sarah are actually next to each other and can talk to each other through event, but I was in a whole other section, and I remained in solitary confinement for 4 months.
Wow, but just a shocking turn of events. Solitary confinement for 4 months, no human interaction?
Yeah, well, at first it was almost zero. The guards wouldn't look at me through the, you know, when they came to give me food in the door, they wouldn't even look at me or talk to me. There were interrogations, and that was one of the reasons I, in fact, was looking forward to interrogation, because it was just someone to talk to. Obviously, it was, you know, this time where I'm sitting blindfolded in a school chair, trying to defend myself from these accusations, but accusations of sort of being sort of standing for my government, being they would try to pin me down to like the things that the U.S. government was doing against Iran and what it was doing in the region in terms of wars and trying to isolate Iran, they were having a real hard time differentiating me as a citizen from the actions of my government. And that isolation really, like, drug on me. And that's why I look forward into interrogations. That's why I would just try to do anything I could to, you know, remember who I was. You know, I didn't have a sense of any, you know, no reflection of myself, no one to, like, really respond to me when I talked. It was just four walls around me. And I, you know, one day I found a pen in the vent of my cell, and that was like this moment of liberation to be able to write and, like, see my own words. Eventually some guards would talk to me. I was able to communicate with some other prisoners. There was one prisoner, I remember, he darted to my cell once on his way to the bathroom and said, are you one of the hikers? And I said, what do you mean, hikers? I hadn't heard anything. And he said, were you hiking in the mountains when you were detained? And I said, yeah, that was me. He said, I saw you on BBC. You're one of the hikers. They call you guys the hikers. So totally disoriented. And so for me, part of having a connection to the outside world was kind of digging deep in myself and finding, you know, who, you know, my identity. And one of the things I hung on to, and we'll talk about this, was sort of sense of being Jewish.
Tell me what that meant. I mean, here you are trying to remember who you are after 4 months in solitary confinement, you know, your interactions, looking forward to meeting with the people who are interrogating you to try to prove you're some sort of American representative or spy. How did you find your Jewish identity? What did it mean to you? What came up?
Yeah, I was sort of swimming against the current in my mind, because for a while I was trying to hide the fact that I was Jewish, that my father's Israeli. My father was born in Iraq before he moved to Israel as a toddler. And I was trying to keep all that under the rug, trying to press it down even in my own mind, because I didn't want it to, like, slip out by accident. You know, sort of in solitary, you know, it's like a kind of a constant fight to make sure I'm not losing it, you know. So but they knew. They actually got into my email and were able to see enough invitations to Passover and enough random emails from my Israeli family and Hebrew that they questioned me on it. And I decided, you know, I'm innocent. I'm not a spy. So I don't need to hide things, you know. It would only make me look guilty if I hide who I am. So I came clean and I told them everything. I said, well, this is my whole family, this is who I am. And they knew. And they said, look, we know you're not a spy, but it's become political. But that relationship I had with myself about trying to hide it for a while, actually, after I let go of that at some point, and I said, look, they already know. They can, you know, they're going to, you know, use that however they want to use that and make whatever story they want. But ultimately they didn't. Ultimately they kept it out of their own media, which was sort of a fascinating decision in my mind, because my family was working so hard to keep it out of the media here on the outside. And then actually the Iranians knew in a couple of weeks and they kept it out of the media. But then I'm in my cell, and I think it was a connection outside, and I started thinking about God, I thought about religion, and I felt I would watch a little bit of the moon come through my window, and I started trying to calculate when would be the full moon, when would be the new moon, when would be the fall holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I went on hunger strike when I first got into prison. And, you know, it wasn't like there was a plethora of food there after a while when I got off a hunger strike. But when Yom Kippur came, I fasted, and it felt like very different from the days of hunger striking, which was sort of this sort of defiant resistance. But on Yom Kippur, me doing it was more about sort of a psychological resistance. It was sort of reclaiming myself and who I am from being scared about who I am to owning it, to being myself.
Did they have any idea you were Jewish?
Yeah, no, like I said, they, you know, they got into my email, and they started asking when they saw my email, you know, all my archived emails forever. They were enough hints about talking about Jewish holidays with my family, or occasional emails that were in Hebrew. Not that I understood them, but sometimes it would be a little bit of Hebrew in my Israeli family's emails that they asked, and then I told them. But like I said, also there, they then decided to keep it out of the Iranian media, which, you know, I can only think was, you know.
It's an interesting decision. I mean, when you think about it, that with so much Iranian, for want of a better term, propaganda about the Zionist entity and, you know, anti-Israel stuff, and that you had Israeli relatives, you would think they would have played it up.
Yeah, you know, really. I mean, you know, I think ultimately they wanted to release me, and at the same time they didn't want to look soft on Israel in any way. So there was this dual thing of wanting to sort of look strong, but ultimately wanting to release me and not put themselves into a bind. You know, there was several comments I got, though, from guards that were almost universal. Like, many of the guards would come up to me and say, and one of them was this comment of, you know, Jewish, when they would find out, you know, the word would get around prison eventually in a few months that I was Jewish, and the guards would say, Jew, no problem. And I learned that Iran actually has the largest Jewish population outside of the Middle East. Iran has the largest Jewish population.
Except for Israel, outside of it. Right.
Except for Israel, yeah. Right. So, you know, they kind of they want to take pride in the fact that they are people of the book, and a lot of guards come up to me and say, you know, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, one God, you know, do this people of the book, like, solidarity. But they'd always, Jew, no problem, and they'd finish that phrase with, Israel problem. And so there's a sharp distinction between politics and the religion was seemed to be, to me, like part of their, I don't know, culture or part of their education system, because it was kind of so universal among the guards saying that.
When you found out you're being released, tell us a little bit about those emotions.
Throughout the experience, I was fighting my own hope. Because every time I would get hopeful, I'd get disappointed. Every time they'd say I have another trial, they'd cancel it. And so I learned to very much not to squash that part of me. But ultimately, I didn't learn to do it as well as my roommate, Shane, who really could kill certain sides of himself. And he... I remember when we were getting hints that it might happen, and one day it was Wednesday, I remember we were running circles in the courtyard outside, and that's what we did for exercise a few times a week when we had a half hour out in the courtyard. We'd run in these little circles, and they'd take us back and normally put us in our cell, but instead of putting us in our cell, they put us into a nurse. And I said, why are they putting us in a nurse? I'm helping. Nothing's wrong with me. And they're like, oh, we just want to check up. It's normally a checkup. But we had already heard from one of the guards and from some hints on the television that we had in our cell at that point that we might be getting free. And so I started poking Shane. I was like, I think it's going to be now. And he was stone cold, like, no, don't talk about it. It's not going to happen. And then they take us downstairs instead of taking us over to our cell, and they give us our stuff, and I just like can't contain it. I'm like, they wouldn't be taking us here unless we're getting free. And then he's still not, you know, doesn't want to get his hopes up. And you know, eventually we see the envoy of the country of Oman, the Sultan of Oman, the envoy, who I had met before in prison a few times. And when I saw him, he grabbed me and gave me a big hug and said, let's go home. And he was the person who had taken Sarah home, the third member in prison, and a year before he had taken her home. So seeing him and hearing him say that felt like, finally, finally happened.
Dayenu.
Dayenu. Yeah, no, it was a, you know, I like, that, you know, Passover is this month, and It was a holiday I celebrated in prison, and it's a holiday that, you know, I love celebrating with my family now more than ever before, because I was the kind of, Jew that my family had to kind of convince me to to do the holidays more than I was doing them. But that one has a strong resonance for me today still.
I want to thank Josh Vital for a great visit. I feel like in some ways we only scratched the surface. The book is called A Sliver of Light. It's available now. And we look forward to seeing what happens next for you. Thank you again, Josh.
Okay, thanks, Sam.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out from Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Menny Hesse, the Minister for Agricultural and Science Affairs at the Israeli Embassy in Washington, D.C. Our playout this morning comes for the coming Festival of Shavuot, Tuesday night, Wednesday, and Thursday, if you're conservative or Orthodox. It's a gospelized version of Romamu, often sung when we carry the Torah, by Josh Nelson, a truly unique Jewish music star today. My friends, may you be blessed with a Chag Shavuot Sameach, a happy holiday of Torah, and a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Come on, help me sing it choir. Romamu.